from the heart of the Forest City, this is a Craig Needles podcast brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
The Craig Needles podcast, of course, brought to you by Lexus of London here at londonnewstoday.ca and classicrock981.com. And I want to talk education today. And kids have been in school for the full week today, at least the kids that are healthy, which is good. We did not have another work stoppage, which is good. But what's the state of the education system in Ontario right now? And I thought, who better to ask about that than Prachi Srivastava, who, of course, is with West University and is an education expert and a tremendous Twitter follower. If you have a chance to use that website while we still, you know, have access to that website. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today and having a conversation with us about education. It's important. I'm glad you could do it. Thank you for this.
Thanks for having me back on, Craig.
So I want to ask you, you know, we get out of this potential with a work stoppage with QP, which is good, and parents can relax a little bit. But at the same time, I think the way this was handled shows us some red flags when it comes to the way our education system has been run and is being run by this government. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. I think some of the issues that we've seen leading up to the strike action and you know, going further over the last 2.5 years have been very problematic.
So first we'll talk about the way that these negotiations happen, and not necessarily the who was right and who was wrong. You know, there's still a ratification that has to occur, but there was a lot of stress for parents. There was a lot of stress for teachers, a lot of stress for students, and I'm sure some stress for the government. But at the same time, it definitely gave off the vibe of it didn't have to be this way, or it felt like it didn't need to go the way that it had, especially coming off the heels of parents all over the province being given $200 or $250 as a essentially a, hey, sorry in advance about a potential strike type of payment. That's the way it came off to me. Is that the way it came off to you?
The money that you're speaking about, I think it amounted to something like $350 million. It came out of the education budget, a budget that's already been cut. The Financial Accountability Office has said it's been cut, despite claims from this government to the contrary. And I think that's really important. I think what is very shocking to me is the level of misinformation that is been disseminated by the government, and the fact that there's very little accountability or very little accountability that's being kind of asked of them to substantiate those kinds of claims. That money would have been much better spent on schools, and actually as a collective, it you know, could amount to something like $60,000 a school, which the last time I checked, and you know, I'm going based on initial teacher salary figures from 2014-2015, because that was the last I had access to. Of course, there might be new data. But the last time I checked, I think it's about 51,000 as an initial entry point for a new teacher coming into the system in Ontario based on those 2014 figures. So that could amount to just having an extra teacher for a school. You know, those kinds of expenditures, they're cumulative. They add up. They can mean a lot more for a system when they're spent in the way that they're meant to be spent. And I think that's a real issue to discuss.
So what would be the best way to spend that money? Because there's a few different spots where the government has some cash lying around, and we talk about transfers from the federal government, and we've seen some pieces about that from the budget office saying, hey, there's some unspent money here that could have or perhaps should have gone to education or to healthcare that isn't going there. We mentioned the funds here. So if Stephen Lecce called you tomorrow, Dr. Srivastava, and said, hey, where should I be spending some of this extra cash? I think that's unlikely, but if he did give you a call, what would you tell them?
I would welcome that call. I think it would be wonderful to have that call.
I hope it happens too. I just think that he's probably not going to dial your number. That's my bet. But
I mean, you know, I think it would be wonderful to have that call. It would show that you know, there's a serious attempt. And I'm not saying they should call me. I'm just saying, you know, to call and find out, okay, if we're not sure where to spend it. my feeling is that it isn't rocket science, Craig, right? Education expenditure in terms of what is required are the basics, right? We have a system that's being put into a situation of a manufactured crisis. And I use this term because many times there are real resource constraints in many, 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 many countries in terms of being able to finance public services, education, and health. Those are real constraints. There are countries that spend more money on servicing their debt than they do on education because they cannot. In the case of Canada, and specifically in the case of Ontario, that is not where we're at. We have the resources. The Financial Accountability Office said that the current spending plan of this government contains $40 billion in funding shortfall over 6 years. It also contains $44 billion in unallocated contingency funds. Those are significant. That is a significant amount of money. In the same context, the same government, according to the plan that they have, is going to cut education by about $12.3 billion over the next 7 years. So the rationale is just not there. We are coming out of a pandemic. Well, I don't even want to say we're coming out of a pandemic because we're still in it, but we're coming out of school, a massive disruption in Ontario, much more than any other province in Canada. We've had 28 weeks of disruption here. And that's much more than any other province in Canada. Incidentally, it's also higher than the European and North American regional averages for school closures. So we really are a true outlier in terms of the level of disruption we've seen here in education. And then we have very many contingency funds and we have budget surpluses. And at the same time, we're seeing budget cuts. And the budget that we do have, we've seen $350 million this year in terms of, parent, they're called cash transfers, household cash transfers is what they're called. In lay terms, everybody's calling them, household payoffs, but that's not what they are. They're cash transfers.
It felt like a payoff when it came into my bank account, but yes.
but they're called cash transfers. $350 million this year, I believe close to $900 million last year. This is coming directly out of the already cut education budget. So that is a significant amount of money that should be used to do the things that we have been saying, at least people like myself and others have been saying, in terms of education recovery in this province, in terms of really changing the curriculum throughout the core to see how it needs to be reframed from JK to 12, taking into account the disruption, putting that money into new programming for psychosocial health and also for core skills for all schools, and targeting resources to the schools and the communities that have had the most disruption, that are facing more challenges than others, because there might be more proportions of children that require assistance, more proportions of children that have that are coming from poverty. All of this is where that money should be going.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's certainly better than sitting, in a stack somewhere or being spread out to parents or whatever it happens to be. It's it just does not feel like the efficient way to go ahead and do this. And sadly, the education system is going to take up the brunt of that mismanagement. And it's going to be, I think, a difficult time for a lot of kids, a lot of parents, a lot of families to get things back to where they could have or should have been if things weren't derailed over the last 2 years. Now, some of that's by COVID. The government can't do a lot about the fact that we had a pandemic, but they didn't necessarily handle that pandemic all that well either.
I mean, I would have to come in there. The government can do a lot about the fact that we had a pandemic.
Sure.
And actually, there were countries that were much poorer than Canada that did a lot better in terms of how they handled COVID, with constrained, severely constrained resources of the type that we cannot even imagine. I'm speaking here of Vietnam, low-income country with three times the population of Canada. And in the first year of the pandemic, instituted policies of, you know, track and trace, of being, you know, very specific about how to kind of run which sectors, which ones closed, which ones opened, to the point where they were one of the first countries to resume schooling. And they had one of the shorter school closures. So, you know, can we predict exactly when a pandemic is going to happen? Can we predict exactly when there's going to be a disaster? No. But when it firstly, there is a question of preparedness. Are we prepared? And secondly, when it happens, what does the government prioritize? In the case of Ontario, it certainly did not prioritize education or schooling. And so, you know, I don't think we can really fall into the idea that there was very little they could have done. There was a lot they could have done. There was a lot both governments could have done, the federal and the provincial government, right at the beginning, mm-hmm. they could have done. And now that we're in a situation where we're facing serious recovery issues, there's a lot that should be done. And for some reason that we cannot understand, is not being done. I want to go back to that, though, because a lot of times the way that governments justify inaction, policy inaction, and this is not specific to Ontario or Canada, just generally, a lot of times the way that governments justify inaction is by saying resource constraint, that, you know, that we just don't have the money. We don't have the money. We have to spend it on a lot of other things. We don't have the money. We don't have the people. We don't have the capacity. In education, a lot of times, we don't have the teachers. We don't have the budget. We don't have... This is how governments justify not putting in the policies that are appropriate. In this case, that's not even it. Mm-hmm. But firstly, it's not even true, right? Because we know that actually there is this huge surplus. But secondly, the government's not even trying to use that discourse. I haven't heard that discourse. I've heard a lot of other discourse, but not about resource constraint. So in a way, the fact that they're not using resource constraint, which is like the easiest and most convenient form of legitimizing inaction, shows that there's something more to it, that even they are aware that that's not a discourse we can use. But then there's no other real rationale provided as to why it is that we are not seeing the kind of action that we should in Ontario for education recovery.
Yeah, I want to be clear. When I said there's nothing they could do about the fact that there was a pandemic, I just mean that COVID-19 existed. Once the management of COVID-19 definitely left a lot to be desired. I would agree with you entirely there. So I just don't know where we go from here, because I know a lot of people, and this goes for both the healthcare and the education conversations. People will look at the system and say, hey, this is really damaged. Should we go to the voucher system? Should we have, private schools? All these conversations. I really don't want to get there. I think that's bad policy. If you want to go to private school, that's fine. But a robust, efficient, well-run public education system is clearly what we should be going for here. Do you understand, though, when people look at it and say, hey, I don't have a lot of hope for the current version of our public education system?
I understand that people are frustrated, mm-hmm. And they're rightfully frustrated with what is happening in education. I think there should be more made of the fact that we have a surplus in budget and a drop in education spending. I think that is on the media to be really, really, you know, putting that message out there and putting it out consistently, because I think that empowers citizens to demand exactly what it is that's going on, and it demands some kind of action. When we talk about questions around privatization, now, Craig, this is a topic that I've been researching for the last 20 odd years. In fact, mm-hmm. it's the thing that I do.
Okay.
I think, you know, most people in Canada, I don't know why anyone would even know me, but anyone who probably has heard me talking about the pandemic. But really what I work on are issues around governance and privatization issues. So whenever we hear things like choice, voucher, parental right to choose, this is all code for introducing privatization mechanisms within the public education system. And that's very specific. It's a very different context than a lot of low income or low middle income countries where there is just outright privatization of the system, where you could have 30 or 40% of students accessing pretty low quality private schools. Actually, they're not all elite. In fact, the elite sectors are quite small. In Canada, we're about, I think nationally, this is off the top of my head, I think we're at about 10% enrollment in private schools. In Ontario, it's about 6% enrollment in private schools. So we have to be careful, because really, private schools in this context are not really the problem. The problem is the dismantling of public education by introducing privatization mechanisms. Vouchers is one such mechanism, depending on how they're constructed, right? So how they're devised. If you use public monies to say to parents, we're giving you a voucher, i.e. we're giving you X amount of dollars, and with that money, which comes out of the, perhaps out of the education budget, you can choose whatever school you like. The idea there is it's unlikely to be able to, for you to be able to access, you know, LCC. Probably, you know, what kinds of schools are open to that kind of voucher mechanism. But what it does is it actually further defunds the public education system. And it introduces a host of forces that have been shown again and again and again over the last 30 years to do all of the things that we would expect. It introduces a lot of inequity. It introduces a general decline in standards. And people would be surprised to know that the literature on relative achievement, that is students in private and students in public schools, does not show a clear private school advantage. A lot of that advantage is really just down to social class factors. So it really works against the public interest. And what's important for us to understand in Ontario is that the vast majority of our population, 94% of the population of children in schools, is in public schools. They are in public schools. That's a win. That's a win for democracy. What's not a win is when you have a government that's systematically trying to undercut that by draining the system of resources. That's the problem here.
Yeah, that's what I don't like. Again, it speaks to the healthcare conversation as well. It feels as though there are times when this government is trying to make our current systems look bad so they can make some sweeping changes that otherwise would never have been politically popular. And maybe that comes off as me being cynical, but geez, does it ever fit for both the healthcare conversation and the educational conversation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, most of whatever I am talking about is very much applicable to the health sector as well. In fact, in the literature, health and education on these topics go kind of hand in hand, right? That actually you want to have well-funded, broadly accessible health and education systems, and that actually they are the best investments. They're the best investments for social economic development for any country. They really are. This is not up for debate. So I don't really know, you know, I'm a little bit hopeful that, you know, there's a lot more discussion now and within the general populace around issues of social justice and equity. I hope that the pandemic has taught us as a society the importance of collective, you know, the importance of the collective. And the importance of everyone doing well. And I was hopeful that, you know, we're in a point now where there are some changes that are happening, but somehow it's not being reflected in our policies here. And I think that is a real problem. And on the part of the government, to me, it's very short-sighted. It's a very short-sighted way of governing. It's a short-sighted way of governing through fear, through, you know, just upset, when there are serious issues that people and citizens are talking about and bringing up every day about their quality of life. It's such a short-sighted tactic. It's very old school politics. The kinds of discourse we heard around the unions and all of this. It's not specific to Ontario, by the way. This happens in every government where there is a push to really do the kinds of privatization mechanisms that you are speaking of, and rightly so. It's not specific to Ontario. This happens everywhere, but it's so old school politics. I really, you know, would like to see a real solid rationale, a question time or something, where people can ask these questions, the point blank question of, when we have a budget surplus, why are there cuts to health and education? What is the reason behind that? To me is the $44 billion question, you know? Like,
yeah.
What is the answer?
Yeah, because that's something that impacts literally every person in this province, is the quality of those health and education systems. And if we're cutting there in order to have a surplus, what's the point of having the surplus? Like what if the government, if the provincial government cannot provide a quality healthcare system and a quality education system, what are they even doing? Because they're like, those are the two most important things by far that they are entrusted to provide for us.
Absolutely. So, you know, I obviously I don't have the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not a very cynical person by nature. But
I am.
I can be skeptical. I'm quite outspoken, but I always speak from the ideal of equity and inclusion and actually just ration, like, logic.
Yeah.
You know, forget, you know, even if we want to say, oh, equity and inclusion, those are airy fairy lefty words. Okay, fine, forget about it. Don't talk about equity and inclusion. Although I think we don't have those things, we have nothing. But let's pretend I don't care about those things. Let's pretend I don't care about those things. Logic. Give me logic. Because on a pure numbers basis, I don't see the logic. Give me logic. Just forget equity, forget human rights, forget everything that we actually fight for in a democracy. Forget it. Give me managerial logic. What is it? Because I don't understand it. I don't understand it from a managerial efficiency perspective. I honestly don't. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. And unless you're trying, yeah, go ahead.
Penny pinching, and this is not penny pinching. This is like huge amounts of money, right? But let's just say penny pinching at the point of spending on schools costs us and hospitals costs us so much more in, and people think long term. No, in like 8 years, right? In 5 to 8 years, it costs us so much more because it has such a negative effect on economic opportunities, on the kinds of jobs that people can do, on skills, on a whole host of issues, on health. So if you're not being able to provide preventative, you know, health measures, if we even look at schools as a coordinating hub for some of those health services, if you're not spending on providing them in the schools, you're going to have huge issues in terms of mental health issues, well-being, occupational therapy lists being so high. No, students are on lists for a year or more to get therapeutic services, diagnostics. So you have to spend so much more in even 5 to 8 years. What is the logic? People talk about efficiency. That's not efficiency. That's not systems efficiency. This is a huge area of inefficiency, of proportions that are completely preventable when you have such a high surplus. So give me logic. Forget rights. Forget equity. And I'm saying that being facetious because, you know, I don't think we can ever forget those things. But you want to come down on me as somebody who's just talking about airy-fairy things. Give me hard fact logic because I don't see it. I just don't see it in the context we're in.
I can't figure it out either. Again, oftentimes the difficult decision to make is because, well, this is better for the people of the province, but it's also expensive. Sometimes the inexpensive decision, and we look at healthcare and sometimes we look at education, the inexpensive decision is also the better decision, and we don't do it. And you're right, from a management perspective, from a logic perspective, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it just, and it's frustrating. And I've got a daughter who's in senior kindergarten. I've got a son who starts junior kindergarten next year. I want the education system to be great for them. And I worry that it is not currently in the best hands to make that happen.
So, and here's the tragedy of all of that is, look, you know, Craig, we don't know each other other than the podcast.
Yeah, via media.
I don't know your household situation, your family situation. I don't want to make any assumptions, but just basing, you know, my comments on research in terms of social class factors and education. Parents that are educated, and I'm assuming that you are given the job that you do, but you know, parents that are educated and have a certain level of income and a certain level of stability, are able to, in some ways, compensate for a little bit of that shortfall, right? Many times in those contexts, parents will outlay for private tutoring. And we've seen an increase in private tutoring actually in this country over the years. They will put in extra money for other kinds of extracurricular resources. Actually, what we're understanding now is that this generation of parents is also benefiting very strongly from social class factors of their parents. So the grandparents of the children, they're able to supplement a lot of those extracurriculars or some of the private. So what ends up happening is when you don't have broad-based coverage of essential services in education, you see a real inequity and people having to make different decisions, perhaps at the household level, to compensate for that. But the problem is we can never truly compensate, right? You can never, because then now it becomes atomized spending, right? You're spending an extra $3,000 a year. The next household is spending maybe $5,000 a year. The next household is spending only $2,000, and the third one is spending nothing or a few hundred because that's all they can actually outlay. What that does is in society, it creates so much inequity that we're always in a situation where we don't have a comparable baseline for all. And in a system where we have financial surpluses, it really doesn't make any sense to do that. I mean, it shouldn't, that's not the system that most countries are actually striving for. If we look at the United Nations development goals, people were like, oh, what does that have to do with us? Well, every country, it has to do with every country. They're global goals. But most countries, low-income countries, they are striving for the kind of system that we have, and that is being dismantled. So when I am in global conferences and I'm speaking with people in different countries and running their systems and even, you know, systems in Europe and the European bureaucrats and education experts can't understand what we're doing. They just don't understand. They cannot understand what is happening here when they learn the facts of what's been going on. And other countries that are low or low middle income countries would love to be in the privileged position that we're in and cannot understand how this would is not something that we're protecting. So all of it is just, again, give me logic in terms of what it is that we are doing, because I cannot understand it.
I don't get the logic either, and I would love to get it. Doctor, I've taken up quite a bit of your time, a little bit more than I said I would. Is there anything else that you wanted to add or make sure folks know about on this conversation before we wrap up our little chat here?
No, I think it's just important for us to keep asking those questions and to keep asking them publicly, because we have to, you know, we are fortunate that we're in we've chosen the system of democracy in our country. And it's very important that the people that are elected, that are making those decisions that have a direct effect on our life, are held accountable to explaining what it is that is directing their decisions on, the two most important portfolios, as you've said, in our system. Health and education are the two most important portfolios for any provincial government, and they're entirely in the control of the province. So I think that's the main question. In a state of budget surplus, why are we seeing these cuts? From a managerial perspective, it doesn't make sense. From a short-term governance perspective for the government, it doesn't make any sense. So they're kind of fighting against their own interest. It really doesn't make any sense. And of course, from the longer, middle, you know, immediate and long-term welfare, well-being opportunities for the citizens and also for our province and for the country, it doesn't make sense.
I couldn't agree more. I definitely have a lot of concerns about it. Thank you so much for doing this and for having the conversation with us. I really appreciate it, Dr. Srivastava. It was a really good chat, and I'm glad you could do it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Craig.
That's Dr. Prachi Srivastava, who, of course, is at Western University and is in the Faculty of Education there as an associate professor. Kind enough to join us here on the Craig Needles Podcast, which is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at Lexus of London, 1065 Warncliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.